Okay, so I've got a good bit tonight. And, you know, I won't make disclaimers up front. I'll just do my best. All right. So this first one, I'm going to get, just go ahead and get it out of the way, because somebody asked last night, what does this mean for the Laurel versus Yanny thing? You know, and it's lucky that I even know what that is, because I am not somebody that goes around searching stuff on Facebook or YouTube. So, but there was a girl at work that had it on her phone, and she ran over to me. She's like, "What do you hear? What do you hear?" And I was like, "Yanny," you know. And then, but then she played it again, and I think it was, I don't know if it was the same Facebook post or if it was a different one, and I heard Laurel. So I was like, "Oh, whatever. That's a stupid thing. I don't even know what that is." So I haven't even researched it. I don't know anything about it. I can tell you that in language, I mean, you're producing, when you were speaking, we're speaking on a pitch. There is pitch to our voice. When we sing, we just sustain it, you know, but there is pitch to our voice, so we're creating harmonics. But language is more complicated in a way, because we have all of the, we have other sounds that are not periodic vibrations. Remember, periodic ones are the musical ones. But sounds in between, like t and k and f. And those are not periodic vibrations. That's what we would call noise, right? That creates an array of frequencies, but they don't follow the harmonic series. It's just a whole bunch of them together. But again, our ear says, "Oh, that's not the harmonic series. That's noise." You know, however our brain does that. And we mix those in between the vowel sounds. So also, when we're singing or when we're making these sounds, the different vowel shapes of our mouth change the intensities of the harmonics. Dan said he has an oscilloscope. You can sing into it and actually see the harmonics that you're creating. And if you change your vowel sounds, the harmonics will be different. Because your head, your neck and your head are resonators, and I didn't even talk about resonance. Because all instruments have resonators on them that help enhance certain harmonics, which gives them their peculiar sound. So it may be that, I don't know what's coming out of the phone. You know, we'd have to know more about what's coming out there, who produced that, where it came from. Like, so I don't really know how to distinguish the difference. And I heard both of them. So I don't know if that's, I'm ambidextrous, whatever that, you know, I don't know what that means. So unfortunately, sorry, I can't answer any more than that. Is the fact that men and women are able to reach notes the other cannot point toward a divine design? And why? I mean, I think all of it points to divine design. I mean, the men don't go as high because their vocal folds are larger. And so men actually, though, have a wider range than women do. Because we can sing low notes very high, and then we can go into our falsetto. All right? And if you're the Bee Gees, it's cool. But some of you look at me right now like, "You're weird, man." But if I was wearing a cool suit with a microphone with crazy hair, it'd be cool. So men have actually a very wide range because they have longer vocal folds, and women's are shorter. So that means the baseline frequency that they can make is faster than men's. Very simple as that. I mean, in talking about men and women, I think just thinking about that in general, the different genders, I think is a very interesting point. It's a very interesting point in evolution, I think, as well. When did genders come about? How did what was the first improvement that was made? Where nature's natural selection said, "Hey, that should be female. Like we need some females. Let's take that improvement and go with it." I think that's a difficult question for them to answer. Where do our eyes work the same way? Light travels in different wavelengths and that causes the perception of color. Would a combination of these frequencies create what we see? I don't know a whole ton about the eye, but I mean, yes, there is it's similar in terms of you're receiving lots of information and your brain puts it together. In the book I was reading about, and I meant to get a bibliography out. I'll try to do that before the end of the weekend. The book that I was reading was talking about how even in visuals, if you look at a word, and of course without a visual, this doesn't go very well, but even if you have, you've probably seen visual illusions or something, but if you just put shadows ever so correctly, you can make it look like it's a word, right? But all the lines of those letters are not there. right? Your eye fills in all the gaps. So in that sense, like we do in frequencies, we have a couple of, we have a pattern, and then we fill in the rest. We definitely do that visually as well. So yes, I mean, it definitely equates that way. Does everyone have perfect pitch? No. And that's because perfect pitch is not the ability to hear. Perfect pitch is the ability to hear something and match it up with our piano, basically. Our musical notation, our musical scale. Because if you think about a piano, you have lots of notes on the piano. Those are not all the possible frequencies that are out there. There's about 6% difference in the frequencies on a piano. Part of that, again, is physical. Because on the basilar membrane, remember how we talked about how it's divided up? About every 3.5 to 4 meters is an octave. And how did the basilar membrane ever figure out to organize itself that way? As you get higher up, that means that there's more frequencies in the same amount of space as you get higher. And so those are all really close together. And so we don't have as much frequency discrimination in the higher frequencies as we do in the lower frequencies, because they're vibrating the basilar membrane closer together. And so when we're hearing two tones at the same time, frequencies, and the amount varies depending on how low or how high it is, frequencies have to be far enough apart for you to hear them as different. Because if they're vibrating kind of in the same place, we hear it as kind of the same thing. And I was thinking about that, I was like, well, that's interesting. But then I thought, well, you know, that's actually kind of helpful. Because if you think about singing in a church situation, now, we know that what matters is the heart. But is everyone singing in tune in church all the time? No. But we're kind of close, right? A lot of people are close. And so we perceive it all as basically the same sound. And so even if you're a little bit off, your ear doesn't bother your ear too much because you're kind of vibrating right around the same place. But perfect pitch is when you can hear a frequency or you can hear the complex tone and say, oh, that's an A on the piano right here. And that's a kind of a special ability that I don't know that we understand completely. And some people, you're just kind of born with it. But you don't know that you have perfect pitch until you learn something about music and the pitches that we use in music. And then you can say, oh, wait, I just happen to know what that is. Okay, so it requires some extra knowledge about music to even know if you have what we define as perfect pitch. Does that make sense? All right, my first question, how much of the brain's ability to recognize a different instrument or sounds is training or experience? That's a good question. From what I was reading, the implication of the research that we have is that it's more natural to recognize, well, let me back up. To recognize pitch is something that's hardwired into us. We can recognize pitch because babies can recognize melodies. Another interesting thing about that, and this actually, maybe I'll come back to that because there's another question that relates to it, so let me try to peg that thought. In terms of recognizing different instruments, that's definitely training. And it's, and again, another amazing thing about the brain. You can hear a clarinet play, and of course you're getting a complex tone, and the harmonics have a certain pattern of intensities to them, well, then you store that knowledge, right? So that when you hear a sound on the radio later, you can say, oh, that's a clarinet, because I went to my storage place in my brain, and I pulled out that frequencies analysis that I had already done, and that the sound that I'm hearing now matches that one, clarinet. Which, again, you think about how much information we're storing in our brain to be able to match up with other things that we hear. But that requires a parent or somebody saying, Johnny, hear that? That's a clarinet. You know, so you have to point out what those are. He's hearing it, but he's not labeling it. So the labeling takes some training, for sure. And scientists, from what I was reading, I mean, we're not positive. I mean, they said either you learn really fast, right, when you come out to recognize pitches, or it's just already in there. But with what we've seen with the harmonic series, how do you learn that? You can't learn that consciously at all. It has to be wired somehow. All right, can you talk about why music from Eastern cultures sounds dissonant to Western ears? And I assume vice versa. That's a good question. First of all, what's interesting about all the cultures of the world well, not, I shouldn't say all the cultures, but if you compare Western to Eastern and some of the scales that come out of different cultures, there's a lot of similarity. In fact, if you look at it, really all the scales, generally all of our scales from across the world are about 5 to 7 notes. 5 to 7 notes that generally refer back to the harmonic series. Those first 6 notes in the harmonic series are generally found in our scales. And so there's a, even though Western or Eastern music might sound dissonant to me, there's actually still some basic fundamental similarity between those. Now, what sounds dissonant to me is a broad idea and rather subjective. I mean, some people might not just like certain sounds of certain instruments. You know, some Eastern instruments, you might just hate the sound of that instrument, period. And you're not used to it. So there's definitely, we have a universal ability to hear the pitches and the sound. But then there's a cultural training that goes on as you grow up, and these are familiar sounds that you hear in your culture. You get used to those, and those are things that you like. And so then when you hear something that's very foreign to that, that's not something that you like, and that's definitely a cultural thing. But however, if you listen to that music a lot, you might start to change your feelings about it. Often our familiarity with it is a lot of the indicator of whether or not we like it or not. I found that in my class, because a lot of people are not familiar with classical music. And so you start playing that for them, and you're like, well, I listen to country. You know, like, okay. But you try to play some of the music, and they're not familiar with it. And part of that, too, with classical music is because it's from long ago, there's a shared understanding that we have with people in music when we're performing. If I'm going to perform a pop song, you have certain expectations of what I'm going to be doing. You may not think that explicitly, but you do. You expect me to have a basic structure, right? You expect me to sing a verse, and then the chorus, and then probably sing another verse, then the chorus again, then a bridge, right? Then the chorus again, then maybe the chorus again, and maybe again, right? So you expect that. For classical music, that was not how the music was structured. And so it's easy for us to get lost because we don't have a sense of expectation of what's supposed to come next. We don't have a relationship with it. And I found that a lot in class. Which goes again, we didn't even talk about this, when you hear a melody, think about the amount of information you're processing in the melody. Right? Every single one of those pitches that you hear is a complex tone for a certain amount of time, followed by another complex tone for a certain amount of time, followed by another complex tone for a certain amount of time. So you're memorizing the complex tones, the amount of time that all those tones are happening, and then you're also memorizing on a macro level. Because in melodies, we don't do a string of information, we do phrases within the melody. For example, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound," is the first phrase of that song, right? That's like a little, like there's a comma at the end of that, right? That's the first idea. And then da 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 da, that's the next part of that. So, but you see, that's another level now that we're talking about, because we're analyzing the frequencies, we're dealing with the next level of just organizing those into single pitches, then we're attuning to the sequence of events that happens of that, then we're memorizing the whole phrase that that was, and following. Do you see how much we're doing? And we don't think about that at all. We just do it. But then when you get all those patterns in a culture, those are all things you're used to hearing and you have stored in your memory and you can recall, and those things are familiar. Okay. How does one respond to an atheist who is insistent on the fact that microevolution proves macroevolution? This is probably one for Dad, because he's done a lot more debating with evolutionists than I have. This is a newer sport for me. And, you know, there's a point with people, I think, where if you can't find some common ground, if you can't find some common logic that you can agree on, I don't know where you go from there. If they can't agree that going from that microevolution is not inherently a proof for macroevolution, we have observed the big, here's the huge, huge difference. We have observed microevolution over and over and over and over and over. We have tried to hit the wall with microevolution. We've tried to break through microevolution in the laboratory. We can't break through it. We've hit it over and over and over. And so why should I, as a human being, then be convinced that a lizard can turn into a bird? Why should I be convinced of that? That's what I think that's the approach you need to take. Make them convince you. Usually they're attacking, and so we feel like we have to go on the defensive and come up with all these facts. The burden of proof is really on them. They're the ones coming up with this theory, not you. So make them convince you that you should believe in evolution. Tell me why I should believe it. Convince me. Give me your best arguments. Lay it on me. If I'm wrong, I want to know. So I think that's the way to come at it. Don't make them just ask you all the questions. There's some good questions for them. So that's what I would say. So if sound is in our head, what are we recording when we save music? That's a great question, because the whole recording thing is a whole nother topic. So just real quick, are you guys okay? I'm talking. I don't want to. You can always leave if you need to go. So. In recording, what's very interesting is recording really imitates what's happening in the ear. I don't even know how much we knew about the ear when we were doing it. I think we knew a good bit. But in a microphone, in the inside of the microphone, what's in there? Some of you know. There's a little membrane inside the microphone that's working like your eardrum. You're singing into it. Your vibrations hit that. It vibrates. Now, what's underneath that, there's like a magnet and a coil. Depends. There's different designs of how they do this. The magnet and coil, your eardrum is creating different pressures or whatever. Some of you engineers, correct me. But that it's a transducer, which means it converts energy from one form to another. So it takes it from being air pressure into electrical signals. Those electrical signals go through the wire. And if you're just going to a speaker, it goes into your speaker. Sometimes there's a little amplifier before it. It takes the signal and boosts it, gives it more energy. And then it sends it to the speaker. And what does the speaker do? Have you ever watched a speaker? Right? What's it doing? It's pushing the air. Just like a string would when you pluck it. It disturbs the air. The speaker is pushing the air in the same pattern as what you were singing. Now, because it's using the complex. Remember the complex tone versus the individual frequencies? That complex tone has a pattern to it, right? Do you remember the picture? It was like up, and then it was down a little bit, and then up a little bit, and down, up, okay, something like that. So that means there's a big compression first, then there's a little bit of lower, I lower the pressure some, then there's a little bit of a bump of a pressure, then I lower the pressure, then there's a little bit of a bump of a pressure, I lower the pressure. Okay, so that's why a speaker can recreate those complex sounds by pushing against the air and just recreating what we produced. Now, when you record it, that's what the computer is saving. But once it goes into a computer, it has to go through a process where the computer takes rapid pictures of it. Okay, so the sound goes in there, and the computer's going, picture, 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 picture. And of course, through math, they figured out what's the rate of pictures that you need in order to recreate a sound effectively. Basically, what the computer is doing is takes the sound, you know, the sound wave, and it's like connecting dot to dot. It creates dots. Dots all along that sound wave. Dot, 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 dot. Those are all the pictures. And if you have enough dots, you know, you've played connected dots. If there's enough dots, you get a pretty good recreation of what it is that you're doing. So the more pictures you take, the more dots you have, and the closer that is to the real thing. But of course, there's always some stuff lost, right? There's some information lost in that process because we can't possibly take pictures fast enough to get every instant of sound. We'd have to take an infinite number of pictures, right, to get all the moments of a sound. But we take enough, and when our ear fills in any gaps, it's good enough for us. So that's what's recorded, and then the computer, when it plays it, translates that back into an electrical signal, which goes to the speaker, which pushes against the sound, which then goes to your ear and does the same thing that it always does. So I said all that because it's an amazing thing that we've discovered that we can do that. But it also, I think of it with intelligent design, it's finding the ear, to me, is like going out in the forest and finding an entire recording studio. Oh, look what nature just... that's what it is. It's definitely equivalent. Do animals hear pitches the same way we do? I did a little bit of research on that. I don't claim to be an expert. And there hasn't been a ton of research on that, actually. That's been more interesting to people lately. But they did some experiments with songbirds because they're looking for animals that have complex auditory systems, and songbirds do. They do complex sounds, and they hear those sounds of their mates and stuff. So what they did was they were trying to figure out if birds have relative pitch perception. And what that means is, if I sing a melody, Mary had a little lamb, but then I go, Mary had a little lamb, did you hear that those were the same melody? Were those the same melody both times? What was different? I didn't go an octave, I didn't go that high, but I went higher, right? I went higher for the second one. But it was the same melody, but it was in higher or lower. So they were trying to figure out if animals can do that. Because that's actually pretty complex. Because you have to remember the sequence of events of those melodies and that's about the relationships of those frequencies to each other that I can then translate to different frequencies that have the same relationships. You get that? That's complicated. But of course, we do it as babies. And they've tried it with babies. Babies can recognize the same melody at different pitch levels. We come out being able to do that. So they say, can birds do that? So they train the birds to hear a certain ascending line of pitches. And when they heard the ascending line of pitches, they were supposed to peck something. And then with a descending line of pitches, they were supposed to not peck or something like that. Okay? So they spent like, I don't know, however long it takes to train a bird to do this. But they actually trained the birds to successfully do that. When they heard an ascending pitch, ascending line, four melodic notes, they would peck. And so they got them to do that. So then but they were the same ones. It was always the same two that they were playing for them. In the same frequencies, I mean. So then they went back to these birds and they said, okay, let's play the same sequence higher and see if the birds still do it. What do you think happened? They did not. They couldn't do it. They did not peck. They did not recognize that when I took this sequence and moved it up, that it was the same thing. So the birds did not do it. They've done some research with monkeys, of course, because those are supposed to be our close cousins, to see if monkeys respond to music at all. So they had an experiment with two cages that were long, and there were speakers at the end of them, and they dropped the monkey in the middle. Monkey in the middle. And the monkeys had to decide. They would play a pitch on one, or maybe it was like a Mozart melody on a light instrument, you know? And then on the other one, it was silence. And they were trying to see what the monkeys would do. Guess what the monkeys did? They went to silence. They did not prefer to go over to that melody playing. They did another experiment where it was like chimps, I think, in their zoo area for them. And they had a speaker that was playing like tribal drum music. Okay, and they wanted to see if these chimps... And the chimps did seem to be curious. They would kind of go a little bit closer to the speaker. But there wasn't really anything super conclusive that came out of that study. But so far, as far as we know right now, the ability, at least for relative pitch perception, is unique for human beings, which that's a huge component of enjoying music, because music is always changing and, you know, and modulating to different places. And there's no evidence that any animals enjoy music the way we do. And that's a whole nother discussion. Why does music even affect us the way that it does? I mean, you can hear a piece of music and instantly be brought to tears. It has no words in it. It doesn't need any words or language. It is the sequence of tones itself, in the combination with the rhythm of that and the harmony of it, seems to touch us in a very deep place, often that we can't even express in language. And how does it do that? Nobody knows. There's books and books and books and books and books have been written about that. And of course, neuroscientists are trying to find the place in the brain, or the combination of places in the brain, that create that emotional experience, the amygdala in the middle, you know, if you know parts of the brain, there's, you know, I don't get it all. But we don't really know. But that's definitely uniquely human experience. And we create music. Animals don't appreciate it, and they're certainly not going to create it. We create it. The other thing I was going to say about that, from an evolutionary standpoint, that's actually an important question for evolutionists, because Darwin said in his book, if there were developments in evolution that are purely for our enjoyment and that's it, that destroys my theory. Why? Natural selection is not about your enjoyment. It's not about you. Natural selection is what's going to help you survive and reproduce to continue your species. And music has no survival value in terms of, it doesn't. It's purely for our own pleasure and enjoyment. Now, you might have a philosophical argument about why music is very important, and I do too, but it's not going to put food on your table, especially if you're a musician for work for a living. You're not going to make anybody do that. But it's not going to feed you, and it's not going to save you from predators with music. Now, what Darwin said, though, Darwin's explanation of music was that it was part of the early mating ritual. Because sometimes, you know, with birds, they're singing to their mate, and that attracts the mate to them. So he theorized that early humans, like Neanderthals, were doing some kind of musical thing to attract their mate. And so that helped them reproduce. is there any evidence for that? Now, it's interesting. I was watching a video of an evolutionist talking about that, and he said, now here's a clip of what it might have sounded like. I was like, are you kidding me? Just postulate your theory and go on. Come on. And it was something like, I was like, you have got to be kidding me. Anyway, does that answer the question? Next question. All right. I'm going to answer this one fast because I probably need to get out of here before I start to break down. Okay, humans' ability to create a new combination of sounds. Yeah, because we understand how this works, I basically created a sound as part of my demo. Did you think about that? That sounded like a clarinet, but it wasn't a clarinet, right? And so in this technological age with all of our synthesized sounds, well, that's how we do it. You can, because of Fourier's theorem analysis, you can combine all kinds of different frequencies and make an entirely new sound that never existed before, which is where all your pop music sounds come from, right? And the electrical, the 70s, right? The 1970s, it's like, hey, we can make a new sound. Let's use it in everything. But that's how we do that, by that Fourier synthesis of sounds. So now we can actually create things that didn't exist before because we've unlocked a small part of what I believe is God's design. And if you take this into a spiritual context, what is something that God tells us to do in worship to Him? Singing. You know, people have different theories about that. And God doesn't tell us why He did that. But don't you see some divine wisdom in telling us to do that? With all the things that we've learned, music is simply there to provides pleasure for us. It provides inspiration for us, however it does that. And there are meanings transmitted through music. And this is a little more of a philosophical argument, but there are meanings it's not just. You can research. You can test it on people. There's meanings transmitted through music that cannot be translated through language. And so I believe that God put that there for us so that we could communally experience the same emotion at the same time for all these things. Plus, I did an experiment one time at church, because sometimes there are hymns with the same words but different music. Have you ever tried those? And so we actually sang two of those back to back. And I just asked the audience, I said, what did you feel during the first one? And then, what did you feel during the second one? And we had very different answers of what we felt like was being conveyed by the music to enhance the meaning of the words between each of those songs. It was not the same. And it's not just, I don't believe it's just so that we're all saying the same words at the same time. Obviously, words are important. We don't want to be singing about something silly. We're going to sing about God. The words are important. But if he just wanted us to be saying words at the same time, we could all get the same version of the Bible and we could chant something together. We could just say it together if that was the only point of it. So I don't think that's the only point of it at all. There's a whole nother layer of meaning experience that comes out of music. And so, again, that's something we all do in worship. And it's one thing we all do together as worship. It's not just one person talking. We can do it all together. And it's mentioned that it's going to be in heaven, too. Now, will it be the same? I don't know. All earthly things done away. Will we have harmonics in heaven? I don't think it really matters. Because it's going to be beyond what we can imagine. But I think it gives us some indication of what God thinks about music. He obviously has some interest in it. And if you think about it from the perspective of the Creator and designing beauty, he wants us to get a notion of how he is like, what he is like. And if you look at music, I think that can help us appreciate that came from God. If you like music, remember, that came from God. So, all right, well, that is all the questions, and it's 9 o'clock, so you guys have been really patient, and I appreciate your very good attention, and I hope the point of all of this is to stimulate your thinking, to stimulate you to seek God. And one of the points I like to say all the time, God is everything you hoped he would be. He is everything you hoped he would be. And if you look at the creation and the amazing design of it and the things that we can enjoy from it, go towards that. Go towards that and find out who he is. All right, I'm done. Thank you.